You remember their names and their homelands and pray for them. Now that the country is heading towards peace, many airplanes take off and land in Baghdad Airport. For many of them, the destination is the Green Zone, where the embassies are located. But you still prefer to be among the defenders of the city. Despite what the general public thinks, the Badr Brigades is not comprised of Iraqi prisoners of war, of those who repent their past. The Badr Brigades is the result of years of hard work by thousands of Iraqis who ventured out to confront the Ba'athist Party and Saddam. When Saddam was on the verge of fall, Abu Mahdi was the commander of the Badr Brigades. In protest against the talks with the invading U.S. forces, he resigned, and along with the jihadi Badr group, who weren't looking for high positions in the government in return for their years-long efforts, formed and trained resistance groups against occupation forces. The Badr group and its well-trained forces formed the core of the popular mobilization forces known as Hashd al-Sha'bi in Iraq. You can see some videos time and time again, and some videos repeat time and time again. The Takfiri's rockets and bullets hit close to Abu Mahdi tens of times. His companions knew very well that nothing could fill his empty place. Because of their heartfelt respect for him, they would only react by protecting him. But the martyr knew something very well, that his life was not more important than the life of any of those youths. He firmly believed in Imam Ali saying that fate alone can protect you. You make shelters, but you don't have any shelter yourself. A few meters in front of the front line, you're driving a loader and you are deeply thinking, when suddenly, from behind the dust-covered window of the vehicle, you see the gray hair of a man. Of course you have to be astonished. When you get out, you will see the most popular man in Iraq. He puts his arm around your neck, and it looks like he doesn't have anything else to do but to spend some time with you. How would he forget you? I testify that you fulfill your promises. You told us about the victories even before the operations kicked off. I remember Samarra, Beji, Tikrit, Fallujah, and Mosul very well. And I believe your last promise that you said, the Euphrates isn't an oil-rich river to keep the lights on for the cowboys. Decades-long presence of the tyrants in Iraq, along with the meddling by the West, was established by triggering and taking advantage of the differences. Things like religious, race, tribe, and family backgrounds, or even issues of less importance, can bring about differences. Only a person who has moved beyond these issues can heal Iraq's centuries-old wounds. These refugees who have become homeless and have managed to save their lives from Daesh and take some of the things in their houses are mostly Sunnis. These refugees are half of the tribe who have fled hurriedly, and the other half was taken hostage by Daesh. Abu Mahdi knows very well that many of them are the families of Daesh militants, so immediately he goes there to protect them. Because he and his companions have risen up for reforms, not corruption. When Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis, with his usual smile, feels he has to be angry with someone who has made a mistake, he only needs to deprive them of his smile. He postpones the operations time and time again and will not order to fire before he is assured that people are safe. A part of your mind is busy about the confrontation with the Takfiris, and another is busy thinking about accommodating and providing the refugees with services and shelter for the night and the next day. Thanks to the internet and the virtual world, Abu Mahdi's pictures and the selfies with him go viral very quickly. The families of the fighters are relieved that not only their children are safe and sound, but they are somewhere safe and away from the front lines. Because security measures never allow the commanders to go to the front lines. But they do not know that Abu Mahdi is not a commander who would command from the capital and watch the fighters from inside a bulletproof vehicle. When you got out of the fight with the Ba'athist party and the hypocrites, we loved you with your salt and pepper hair and your coat that belonged to Badr. But your gray hair is a different story. The Haditha massacre, the Abu Ghraib victims, and thousands of children and women who were killed in Fallujah and the Mahmudiya massacre made your hair strands white one by one while you were grieving for the children of Iraq. Following up on opening the closest makeshift hospital in an operation zone for the injured and designing high embankments to stop any possible damage from suicide car bombs made the number of the martyrs less and less by the day. Al-Muhandis, or engineer, wasn't just Abu Mahdi's epithet. You and your fighters changed the geometry of a war that could change the geography of the region. It isn't something beyond imagination that after the flames of war are out, some commanders show up in political games. But you're like you were in the past, and your path is still different. You check the tracks of the front lines in the morning so the soldiers are not overjoyed with the happiness of the victory. In the afternoon, you visit the barracks of the injured soldiers who could be forgotten very quickly. It doesn't look like that you had kissed all of the martyrs in Iraq before their martyrdom. Whenever an explosion happened and the sirens of an ambulance was heard, you would get worried on behalf of everyone. You saw martyrs for 50 years, but no one's death ever became normal to you. What time in history do you remember when you hear these words? The land of Iraq. The rebels of the Levant and Iraq. The massacre of children. Beheading men and taking women hostage. Sayyid Murtaza Avni has beautifully said, "The companions of the Master of Martyrs, Imam Hussein, peace be upon him, have come at the end of history to take revenge for him." War is bad, but it has a strange poetic feeling in it. We always think there is a bullet or a rocket lying in wait for us. If not me, my comrade is about to die. That's why fighters always open their arms to one another. There is no difference between news of victory, the news of a fighter's martyrdom, and the news of the arrival of a popular commander. They're just an excuse to show us what death smells like. Come on. Put yourself in a place of a militia fighter who's been fighting for 40 years. And put yourself in place of a commander who has a brave and well-prepared army. It'll be surprising if you're not strict and don't act with authority, but there's no trace of the relationship between a soldier and commander in the huge number of the fighters who are coming to you. It doesn't even look like a leader and his proteges. You're always like a father who has sent his son to the war after giving him a copy of the Quran, and now he is happy that his son is alive and well. The Iranian fighters, in contrast to the Ba'athists, had a famous phrase, and they would even write it on the back of their khaki shirts. Ablutions in the Euphrates and prayers in Karbala. You had told the Iranians that the slogan had come true. God willing, we'll say our prayers in the Al-Aqsa Mosque. How close you and Haj Qasim were to the slogan. Despite its several thousand-year history, Iraq was like a small child in the arms of an experienced father. The Iraq that saw nothing but destruction from the Ottomans, the Ba'athists, the Americans, and Daesh. And you were right when you said Daesh isn't the continuation of the Ba'ath, but the Ba'ath itself that has emerged in another form. Fighting with the devil, who was in fight with everything, was really strange. Daesh was in fight even with the past. Infidelity was an excuse to destroy the believers' graves and the shrines. Even the ancient monuments were not safe from them. They destroyed the Palmyra Museum in Syria and the Hatra ancient city and Hazarmerd in Iraq. It was you who told us that you never had the time for a trip or entertainment. With the aim of jihad, you traveled all across Iraq and visited everywhere. As you said, you went to all those places in Iraq you hadn't seen and saw them with your forces. In Abu Mahdi's lineage, we're not looking for Iranian blood, and we are not proud of him just because he speaks Farsi. But don't consider the engineer just an Iraqi. Don't consider him an Iranian either. Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis is a commander who has something to say, not only in the battlefields, but in the media. All those years, you always mentioned Haj Qasim's name, who got martyred with you many times, and God gave him back to you as a gift again. Not just as a companion brother or an eternal friend, but as a commander, and you considered yourself his soldier. He goes to the martyrs' families in the evenings. The martyr's mother is sure that Abu Mahdi has seen his son and kissed him before martyrdom. I think hard about the words, and I regret that a poet came up with these words before me. The difference between a martyr's mother and all other mothers on earth comes down to this. A martyr's mother, before becoming a martyr's mother, becomes a martyr. Thank you. People in Iraq have been on the verge of victory time and again, but the last-minute differences have always ruined everything. The Iraqi Revolution in 1920 against the British, Martyr Sadr's uprising, and the Sha'ban Intifada are among them. But you're the son of your time. You changed the game of differences. You picked Hashda Sha'bi from among all groups, the Christians, Assyrians, Izzadis, Shias, and Sunnis. They are all with each other and they are soldiers of the homeland. You always do your duty. In Hashda Sha'bi, you founded and commanded. The bitter history for forgetting Abu Zainab's and Abu Maysam's should not be repeated. When these images are broadcast by the public media, they run reminders on the screen that the video was recorded before the spread of the coronavirus, and that is the most obvious sentence after your martyrdom. Have you ever seen a world that has lost its hero? So you can see what situation we're in. Whose hand can we shake from now on? And who can we kiss? It's even better that the coronavirus is with us and the masks have covered our pale faces. We did our job. But it was really hard to say goodbye to someone who had forgotten about the world altogether. He was tired, but we were still anxious to film him. In the end, he invited us to the recitation of the Quran with his nice voice. The verses about the status of those who had attained salvation and those were shamed, death and limbo, the hereafter and resurrection. Later on, I heard that those who recite the Al-Waqi'a Surah will be among Imam Ali's companions and followers. Commander, hero, general, all of them are beautiful words. But when it comes to homeland, you cannot find any word more beautiful than soldier. It reminds me of the line by a poet that goes, "Millions of years later, people will find the fossilized heart of a soldier and will forget it in the museums of geology." But how is it possible to forget you? But how is it possible to forget you?
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
In the limelight.
In Britain, the Trades Union Congress TUC has said ministers are in talks with 13 countries with poor track record on employment rights. The article you're about to hear has been written by The Guardian's economics correspondent Richard Partington. The piece is titled, TUC Issues Workers' Rights Warning Over Post-Brexit Trade Deals. In Britain, ministers have been accused of pushing post-Brexit trade deals with more than a dozen countries around the world that do not guarantee workers' rights or systematically violate employee protections. The Trades Union Congress TUC said ministers were in active talks with 13 countries with a worrying track record on employment rights, including countries like Brazil, Burundi, Saudi Arabia, and Qatar, in order to secure trade deals after leaving the European Union. It comes as tensions mount between unions and the British government amid strike action over pay and conditions, with Boris Johnson's administration accused of deploying culture war tactics to drive a wedge between unionised staff and the rest of society. Ministers have promised law changes to help reduce strike disruption by allowing employers to hire agency workers to cover staff. Union leaders said the government was showing total disregard for workers around the world. According to a report from the International Trade Union Confederation, ITUC, the union's global umbrella group, sackings at P&O Ferries, where 800 workers were fired with no notice and no consultation, was one of the clearest examples of labour abuses around the world. The Trades Union Congress, TUC, said that a government that readily agrees deals with countries that abuse rights abroad is one that won't stick up for rights at home either. It called on ministers to stop attacking fundamental trade union rights and to make good on its promises to improve workplace protections. The government had promised 18 months ago that union representatives would have a place on powerful post-Brexit trade advisory groups, panels set up to be consulted on the text of trade negotiations, but had so far failed to confirm any appointments. Currently, only businesses have seats on the group. The Trades Union Congress, TUC, said the continued failure to properly consult unions in trade talks was leaving workers around the world worse off, with ministers agreeing deals lacking any enforceable labour standards. Out of the 67 non-European Union countries the British government has negotiated trade deals with, as many as five are listed in the 10 worst countries in the world for workers, according to an index published by the ITUC. And these include Colombia and Egypt. As many as 10 countries are placed in the 44 countries with no guarantee of workers' rights, including countries like Ecuador and Jordan, while 8 countries are among the 38 nations where there is systematic violation of workers' rights, including countries such as Australia and Vietnam. Last week, the government kicked off talks in Riyadh, Saudi Arabia, to agree deals with countries covering £33.1 billion of trade across the Persian Gulf Cooperation Council, the PGCC, made up of nations including Bahrain, Kuwait, and Qatar. However, the Trades Union Congress, TUC, said talks with these countries should be suspended because of their record unemployment rights, saying no push ahead would risk giving countries a free pass on abhorrent labour rights in a rush to agree post-Brexit deals. Paul Novak, the Deputy General Secretary of the Trades Union Congress, TUC, said ministers are in talks with a dozen countries which are some of the worst offenders when it comes to workers' rights. This will fuel a race to the bottom of rights. a government that readily agrees deals with countries that abuse rights abroad is one that won't stick up for rights at home either. Instead of treating trade agreements as publicity tools, the British government should be using its leverage on the global stage to ensure respect for fundamental workers' rights. A Department for International Trade spokesperson said, "We maintain a high level of protection for our labour standards and will not compromise them in any of our trade agreements. As well as meeting our obligations under the International Labour Organization, ILO, we continue to advocate for the highest labour standards and working conditions globally, including working towards eradicating modern slavery in global supply chains."
Hello, I'm Mubarak Kenya, and a big welcome to this week's edition of Africa Today.
Stay tuned with Africa Today.
Africa Today.
Russia's military operation in Ukraine continues to affect the whole world. Thousands of miles away, the West African country of Mali is emerging as another front for escalation between Moscow and the US-led NATO military alliance. Mali has not only ejected France, a former colonial power and a key NATO member, but is also now acquiring Russian military hardware to boost its war on terror. The country's defense minister speaks here when receiving military choppers delivered by Russia.
The Malian state bought these helicopters from the Russia Federation, a friendly country with which Mali has always maintained a very fruitful partnership. It's the realization of a contract signed in December 2020, taking effect in June 2021.
Hello, I'm Mubarak Kenya, and warm welcome to Africa Today, a weekly program that gives you an alternative view of events making headlines in Africa. In the first segment of our program today, we are focusing on how Mali has become a battlefront for Russia and the US-led NATO military alliance. We're asking, as Mali moves to fully embrace Russia, is NATO plotting to topple the government in Bamako? The second part of our program will be on the refusal by the Belgian king to apologize for his country's atrocities in the Congo during the colonial era. Our experts will give us their incisive analysis on today's topic. So join us until the end of our show.
Russia versus NATO in Mali. The US-led NATO military alliance is currently engaged in an indirect war with Russia in Ukraine. The impact of this conflict is being felt across the world, including in Mali, a strategic West African country that is now emerging as a major focal point of escalation between Russia and NATO. France sent its troops to Mali in 2013. To ostensibly battle terrorists and insurgents. However, since the deployment of the French, the situation did not improve, and in fact, attacks by insurgents have increased. Insecurity was a major factor that led to military takeover in Mali.
The military officers who took over in Mali have established closer ties with Russia in a bid to restore stability in the country, a move that has angered Western powers in the NATO military alliance. Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov confirmed that Mali requested the assistance of a Russian military contractor to combat terrorism in the country.
They are combating terrorism, incidentally, and they've turned to a private military company from Russia in connection with the fact that, as I understand, France wants to significantly draw down its military component, which was present there, and as everyone understood, should have been combating terrorists who established a presence in Kidal, but they didn't manage to do that.
Now, for more on how Mali is becoming another front in the confrontation between Russia and the US-led NATO military alliance, we contacted Imani Naumoja, a Central Committee member of the All African People's Revolutionary Party. Thanks a lot, sir, for your time. Now, why is Mali turning into a front in the Russia versus NATO conflict.
It does appear as though Mali's become an affront in the ongoing conflict between NATO and Russia, and we can even say between NATO and the world. Of course, there'll be other fronts. But it'd be very important for our viewers to understand that the relationship between Mali and Russia is not a new relationship. Even before the Russian Federation was formed, when there was the former Soviet Union, USSR, it had a very close relationship with Mali, particularly in the first years of independence from 1960 until the backwards reactionary coup d'etat against Modibo Keita that took place in 1967, which was caused by the French imperialists with the U.S. Imperialists behind them. It's also important for our viewers to understand that the United States capitalists are involved in that struggle. They're the ones who gave the transportation to the French forces that went into Mali in 2012 in their fight against the quote-unquote terrorists that they themselves trained. And it's also them that wants to steal the resources of Mali, the petroleum, which they have a lot of, the uranium, which they have a lot of, which the imperialists need for their nuclear power, for their nuclear energy, in addition to a lot of other resources that we have in Mali.
Speaking at the UN General Assembly last year, the Malian Prime Minister has accused France of abandoning his conflict-torn country following its decision to withdraw most of its forces last year. In an apparent reference to Russia, the Prime Minister said Mali is justified in seeking other partners in its war on terror.
The new situation resulting from the end of Operation Barkhane puts Mali before a fait accompli, abandoning us mid-flight to a certain extent, and it leads us to explore pathways and means to better ensure our security autonomously or with other partners so as to fill the gap which will certainly result from the withdrawal of Barkhane in the north of the country.
How is Mali's closeness with Russia impacting on the country's war on terror?
In our opinion, Mali's closeness with Russia will intensify its ability to combat the terrorist groups that are terrorizing our people throughout the country. Let's look at the logic. It's clear, it's an open secret, that it was the French and the U.S. and the United States that gave arms to the terrorists they claim to be fighting against. The terrorist groups particularly got a lot of strength during the invasion of Libya in 2011. Mali has a border with Libya, as you mentioned. So a lot of the arms came straight from the United States or France to Libya, right over across the border to Mali, in the hands of the terrorists, which were trained by the United States and France. The Al-Qaeda group in Africa, trained by the United States. The Ansarab terrorists, trained by the United States and France. They themselves have said it. So it's only natural. You don't have to be a fortune teller to know that now that the French troops have been chased out of Mali, that they will intensify their arms shipments to these terrorist groups and recruit more mercenaries to help these terrorist groups to increase their attacks against the people of Mali.
France has withdrawn most of its forces from Mali, but Paris and other NATO members have been increasingly worried about Russia's growing influence in this West African nation. In what is seen as an attempt by Western powers to topple the pro-Russian government in Bamako, there was a reported coup attempt in Mali on the 16th of May. After the failed coup, Mali's government spokesperson, Colonel Abdoulaye Maiga, appeared on the country's national TV and issued the following statement.
These soldiers were backed by a Western state. The attempt failed thanks to the vigilance and professionalism of Mali's defense and security forces.
Western powers continue to be critical of the pro-Russia policies adopted by the current military leadership in Mali, which enjoys support of the country's masses. To regain their influence, NATO powers influenced by France are said to be actively plotting behind the scenes against the current leadership in Mali, with a view of toppling it and replacing it with a puppet and subservient regime.
No question at all. It's more than certain that France and their allies are plotting to overturn the regime in Mali. No question. Because they were chased out. And they have a lot of interest in Mali by being so rich and so big.
Malians have been holding demonstrations in the capital, Bamako, and other parts of the country to support their military leadership and its military cooperation with the Russians, which they believe will restore peace and stability in their country. A Malian pro-government activist speaks here in support of the deployment of military advisors from a Russian private military company known as the Wagner Group.
If Wagner went to liberate Syria, if Wagner went to liberate the Central African Republic, then we welcome Wagner to Bamako to liberate Mali. To the asymmetric war, we propose an asymmetric solution, which is Wagner. This is the truth, and today it is the end of France-Africa.
Now, is it in the interest of Malians to have closer military ties with Russians and abandon NATO military powers, especially France?
From our perspective, it's in the interest of the people of Mali to have relationships with those on an equal basis of respect with any and every country in the world. But in this case, we don't want to exchange Western powers for Russia, etc. No, we're not aligned. We're part of the non-aligned movement. But for sure, we don't want anybody ruling over us. So in this case, of course, we need to shake off the shackles of Western imperialist domination and neocolonialism. And with countries like Russia, which are superpowers, which want to assist us on the basis of respect, of course, we welcome that. Not only with Russia, but with China, the People's Democratic Republic of Korea, with Vietnam, with Cuba, Venezuela, any and every country in the world on the basis of mutual respect. Think with our own heads, walk on our own feet.
In October 2019, Russian President Vladimir Putin hosted the Russia-Africa Summit, which created good conditions for expanding fruitful cooperation at the bilateral level and on the multilateral basis. In his speech, he highlighted the historical and anti-colonial ties between Russia and Africa.
Russia and Africa are tied with traditionally friendly relationship. Our country has been consistently supporting the national liberation movement of the peoples of Africa. It has contributed significantly into the emerging of young states, developing their economy, establishing combat-capable armed forces. Our cooperation, which goes back to the period of joint fight against colonialism, is of strategic and long-term nature. And of course, we have vast possibilities for galvanizing Russian-African cooperation in various spheres.
Russia's presence in Mali is seen as part of its efforts to renew all partnerships with the African continent amid attempts by NATO to isolate Moscow internationally. Now, will more African countries embrace Russia?
You will see that particularly in the 1950s and the 1960s, that Russia had a relationship with a lot of countries in Africa. And in that relationship with Africa, in that relationship with the African countries, it was a just relationship. They never colonized the countries in Africa. There may have been some mistakes that were made, but they had a partnership. So, yeah, I do believe that in the future, there are a number of countries in Africa that still embrace Russia, not as a master, not as a former colonizer, no. We embrace Russia, like we embrace China, like we embrace Cuba, like we embrace any country that we sovereignly decide to embrace. And I believe that that will increase. Because again now, the development of Europe came about because of the underdevelopment of Africa. So as Africa develops, it's only natural that countries like France were somewhat underdeveloped because most of the resource, the overwhelming majority of the resource they have come from us. So of course, we have no choice but to embrace equal sovereign countries based upon our own conception, decision of our people and our interests.
Well, our guest there says it's in the interest of Africa to reestablish all ties with Russia based on mutual respect. I'd like to thank Imani Naumoja for his insight today. Our next topic is on the recent visit by the King of Belgium to the Democratic Republic of Congo and his refusal to apologize over atrocities committed by his country in the Congo during the colonial era. But before our discussion, let's take a short break.
Belgium not apologizing for crimes in Congo.
You're listening to Africa Today. Africa Today is an analytical weekly review of political, economic, and social events in Africa, the world's second largest continent. The series is broadcast every week on Saturdays and Sundays by IRIB English Radio.
Belgium's King Philip visited the Democratic Republic of Congo early June, and as expected, he flatly refused to apologize for his country's brutal and inhuman crimes in the Congo. King Philip only offered what he termed as his deepest regrets for his nation's colonial era genocide and extermination of millions of Congolese people, including women and children. The Belgian king was too arrogant to apologize for the genocidal crimes committed by his great-grandfather, King Leopold II. Many people in the DRC were critical of the king's speech.
Belgium should first of all recognize all the atrocities that were committed in the Congo during the colonial period. They looted our country and sold our ancestors as slaves. For the king to acknowledge those abuses without issuing an apology or financially compensating people was really an empty speech.
Now, for more on the refusal by the king of Belgium to apologize for his country's crimes and atrocities in the Congo, we contacted Nefta Freeman, a coordinating committee member of the Black Alliance for Peace. Thanks a lot, sir, for your time.
Mm-hmm. Thank you for having me.
Now, why did the King of Belgium refuse to apologize for his country's colonial era atrocities in the Congo and decided to offer what he termed as regrets?
Well, They can't apologize. Regrets means that they're not acknowledging any responsibility for it. They just regret it about it. And the reason why they can't do it, the reason why none of the Western world or Western powers can acknowledge the conditions of Africa, in this case, particular case, the Congo, and what Belgium's responsible for, its colonialism, is this pure racist arrogance. They just can't, you know, take responsibility for what they've done.
King Leopold II established his country as a colonial power in Africa and is infamous for the widespread atrocities committed under his rule. According to standard historical data, King Leopold II led a campaign of looting and terror resulting in the mass killing of over 10 million people in the Congo.
Another atrocity by Belgium against Congo occurred within 3 months of independence when Belgium, in collaboration with Britain and the United States, organized the overthrow and assassination of Prime Minister Patrice Lumumba. Now, briefly elaborate on the magnitude of Belgium's genocidal crimes against the people of Congo.
Oh, wow. Yeah, the Belgian crimes against the Congo and the people of the Congo could make Guinness Book of World Records, an enslavement of the Congolese people that even included the dismemberment of people for punishments for not, you know, working fast enough or something like that. This even included children dismembering people's limbs. The collaboration, even coming all the way up to more recently, the collaboration between Belgium and the U.S. to install the dictator Mobutu Sese Seko, who served as the puppet for neocolonialism against the Congo for over 32 years. And then today, now, as a result of the destabilizations and the conflicts, there are over 200 armed groups competing for territory in the Congo because of the natural history unfolding of the history of the Congo was interrupted by Belgian colonialism.
Apart from the apology, the people of Congo are also demanding reparations for the atrocities committed by Belgian King Leopold II during his reign of terror in the Congo. The masses in Congo insist that the regrets expressed by the Belgian king will never be enough. and that this former colonial power must grant reparations to the victims of colonization and their descendants.
Absolutely. Reparations must be demanded by the Congolese people, and the government of Congo, if it's worth its salt, should be demanding reparations. The Congo still suffers from massive unemployment and the violent conflicts, particularly violence of the groups, rebel groups of M23, groups backed by the U.S. proxy, Paul Kagame's government, and Rwanda. These reparations, meaning to repair, would be to solve these issues. And then it's impossible to address reparations but not address the new colonial disposition of the Congo not being able to control its own natural resources, how the Western world depends right now on the subservient, destabilized Congo, the superstructure that maintains the extraction of cobalt and coltan and gold and diamonds that the Western world makes super profits off of, and Congo really as a market for the military-industrial complex.
Many people in the Democratic Republic of Congo were critical of the visit by King Philippe, saying it has revived old wounds inflicted on the nation during the brutal rule by King Leopold. A Congolese citizen says the only objective pursued by the Belgian king during his visit to the Democratic Republic of Congo is to continue looting the country's natural resources.
I wish that our president would take care of what's important to the Congolese instead of creating useless expense by inviting the royal couple. We have important things to settle here, like free education. Teachers are not well paid, but the president prefers to invite the Belgian king. To do what? To loot us again?
We asked Mr. Freeman about the reaction of the Congolese to the visit by the Belgian king.
Well, African people and the Congolese people, it was indignation, point blank, that people still feel the sting of the blatant assassination of their first democratically elected president, Patrice Lumumba. And even right now, there was a raid then where the Belgians were able to recover one of Lumumba's, one of the teeth, a tooth of Patrice Lumumba, and that tooth, that evidence that means that, because people still don't know the body and those type of, you know, that there's no body. And so of Lumumba and other people. And so when you recover something like that, it begs that there should be an continued investigation. In other words, that's the lead, right, to solving what actually happened in particular to Patrice Lumumba. But they didn't even bothered to bring that. They brought some mask, an artifact or something like that. And then again, as you pointed out earlier, only expressed regret. But the people need more regret, and the people know these things. So when these things are uncovered in the media and the news, the people are following them. So they can only have indignation, and that was what happened there.
Well, speaking during a press briefing, President Tshisekedi said, "We have not dwelled on the past, which is the past, and which is not to be reconsidered, but we need to look to the future." Now, adding that he was focused on new collaboration with Belgium.
The aim here is to build something new and, above all, something definitive that is constructive for both our countries.
Now, while the masses demand reparations, the Congolese government seems more focused on moving on. What's your take on this?
Well, the take on is that clearly the government is not prepared to take the radical measures that it would take to represent the people. That neocolonialism means that it has all the trappings of independence, but the politics and the economy of the Congo and all of Africa is controlled by outside. So the leaders that are in place, even including President Tshisekedi, are what we refer to as compradors. And so when he say moving and not looking at the past, well, one thing we know that the present and the conditions of the present can only be understood by looking at what preceded it, how the context and the leading up to the conditions that happened. And they can only be addressed by looking at what's happened in the past, acknowledging it and its all its intricacies. And the position of the president actually demonstrates or shows how much how fearful that the leadership has. I mean, if you take a radical stand, you know, the others, they will assassinate you or invade your country or something like that.
Well, there you have it. Congo will only have a bright future if it looks at the past, but unfortunately, former colonial powers are a stumbling block to the country's progress and prosperity. I would like to thank Mr. Freeman for his incisive analysis. Well, that's it for this week's edition of Africa Today. It's been great having you. So send us your comments through our social media handle and let us know your opinion. Thanks a lot and goodbye for now.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
Congresswoman Liz Cheney, vice chair of the congressional panel investigating the January 6 attack on the U.S. Capitol, has warned that former President Donald J. Trump represents a domestic threat that we have never faced before. We have prepared for you an article written by Martin Pengelly. The piece is titled "Explosive Testimony Piles Pressure on Trump. How likely are criminal charges?" Six televised hearings, the House January 6 committee has presented extraordinary testimony about Donald Trump's attempt to overturn the 2020 presidential election and its culmination the deadly attack on the U.S. Capitol by a far-right mob. The committee is made up of 7 Democrats and 2 rebel Republicans, Adam Kinzinger and Liz Cheney, who refused to follow their party in bending the knee to Donald Trump. Set free of bipartisan considerations when the House Republican leader Kevin McCarthy withdrew cooperation, the panel has been able to act in a purely prosecutorial manner. It has also worked on how to present its findings, using television industry expertise to present hearings honed, contained, and aimed at convincing the American public that Donald Trump should never be president again. The committee cannot charge Donald Trump with a crime, but the U.S. Department of Justice can, a possibility that has stoked intense speculation in Washington and the world. But here are the key legal issues. Can the committee make criminal referrals? Yes, it has done so in the cases of Steve Bannon, Peter Navarro, Mark Meadows, and Dan Scavino, Donald Trump aides who refused to cooperate with the committee. Pleading not guilty to criminal contempt of Congress, Steve Bannon and Peter Navarro faced time in prison. The Department of Justice declined to charge Dan Scavino and Mark Meadows. Will the committee refer Donald Trump? The chair of the House committee, Benny Thompson of Mississippi, has said he does not expect to do so. However, that statement prompted reports of disagreement on the House panel and also came before Liz Cheney, the vice chair of the panel, revealed possible attempts to intimidate witnesses. On Wednesday, CNN asked the committee member, Pete Aguilar of California, if he believed witness tampering had occurred. Pete Aguilar said, "Yes, I do. I think that's something that should be looked at by our committee and potentially by the Department of Justice." Asked if a referral had been made, Pete Aguilar said, "I'm not going to talk about the investigative steps we have taken, but what I will say is I think that those statements speak for themselves as evidence of dangerous behavior." One of the witness statements, which Liz Cheney read on Tuesday, 28th of June, was reportedly made by Cassidy Hutchinson, a former close aide to Donald Trump and to Mark Meadows, who testified for 2 dramatic hours. Could the Department of Justice charge Donald Trump? The House committee has turned up extensive evidence that suggests a case could be made. Cassidy Hutchinson appeared to draw Trump closer to strong links with extremist groups which attacked the Capitol, saying she recalled hearing the word Oath Keeper and hearing the word Proud Boys closer to the planning of the January 6th rally, when Rudy Giuliani would be around the White House. Rudy Giuliani was Donald Trump's personal attorney. Among more than 870 people charged over the Capitol attack, members of the Oath Keepers and Proud Boys have been charged with seditious conspiracy. But to many, one passage in Cassidy Hutchinson's testimony seemed to draw Trump the closest yet to demonstrable criminal conduct. Hutchinson said Donald Trump knew the crowd for his speech near the White House on 6th of January 2021 contained armed individuals, some with AR-15 rifles and handguns, but still told his audience to march onto the Capitol and fight like hell to stop certification of